And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
Welcome, everybody, to Soccer 101. My name is Taylor Rockwell, and this week we've talked about the Champions League. We've even talked about the CONCACAF Champions League. We're talking about the Continental Club competition that we should probably talk about a bit more. The Copa Libertadores. To do so, I'm joined by Mr. Copa Lib himself, Graham Ruthven. Hello, Graham.
Hello, Taylor Rockwell. How are you? Are you ready to talk about the best tournament in world soccer named after the leaders of the Latin American Wars of Independence?
Because no,
that's the Copa
yes.
Libertadores.
Yes.
This should, by the way, be a common naming convention for tournaments. Name them after freedom fighters. I can't wait to watch Stirling Albion play in the Copa William Wallace.
When we used to do, when in our World Cup previews used to feature like a bit about the national anthem, and I do love that almost every South American country's national anthem has some line in there that disparages the Spanish in some different way. So they always have a shot at the Spanish, and I guess even their continental competition has the same.
I thought you were going to say a shot at America. I guess that's not quite so, so that would be a bit more modern, but yeah, that's where I thought you were going with that one.
Modern and historic. We've been destroying their political stability for a good long while. But let's not talk about that, Graham. I will say I am apprehensive to cover this topic because it is such a huge topic with such a massive history that I am really... It's not that I'm unfamiliar with, I just don't feel like I have even the passing familiarity that lots of people do. So it feels like a lot to bite off, but we're going for it. Why are we going for it? Let's start there.
Well, essentially because as you kind of hint at there, Taylor, the Copa Libertadores is such a huge deal. You know, after the Champions League, the European Champions League, it is the biggest, most prominent, most historic regional club competition in world soccer. And yeah, that's maybe a good place to start off. It is South America's Champions League. So it's operated by CONMEBOL, which is the Confederation for South American Football. It is the regional club competition for that part of the world. It's the highest level of club soccer in South America. It covers the 10 national associations of CONMEBOL. And it is played every season. And the group stage for this season started this week. So that's kind of the news hook of why we're doing it. I know these episodes are evergreen, but that's why it popped into our minds. The 10 member countries, by the way, are Argentina, Bolivia, Brazil, Chile, Colombia, Ecuador, Paraguay, Peru, Uruguay, and Venezuela. And each country can send a minimum of 4 teams into the Copa Libertadores every season. There are qualifiers, and some countries get more qualification spots than others. But every country is represented in some way. And I think everyone would agree that South America's footprint as a continent on world soccer is a deep and profound one. And so it feels like the Copa Libertadores should maybe be given a little bit more attention than it is given. So that's what we're going to try to do today.
And I think obviously, the imbalance in money and the increasing imbalance in money as time has gone on is why maybe it has gotten second shift, sort of, because you have so many very talented South Americans moving to Europe at such young ages to play in those leagues, in those competitions. If you had those South Americans staying in South America, I think Copa Libertadores gets that much more exciting and engaging. So I think there are reasons historically why maybe the importance or the coverage of the tournament hasn't been as big as it deserves. But it is a obviously historically significant tournament, but also a tournament with a lot of history. It dates back to, if you want to say the 1940s or even the 1930s, you could. I guess those would be seen as like the continental origins of competition, but really the founding itself is what, 1960? And yeah. It's very odd to go back, read about the history of the competition, the founding of the competition, and come away with the idea that maybe João Havelange didn't just take money and do corrupt things. He actually did useful things. I'm confused.
Well, he did that as well. Yeah. Okay. The two things aren't mutually exclusive. But you're right. João Havelange, he is written into the origin story of this competition. So as you mentioned, Taylor, in the 30s and 40s, you have a number of tournaments that were sort of invitational competitions between various different countries in South America, but nothing official or sustained over a prolonged period of time. And the origin of the actual Copa Libertadores has its roots in the Intercontinental Cup, which was a precursor to the Club World Cup. It was not quite as sprawling as the Club World Cup is or is about to become, certainly. It was a one-off match between the champions of Europe versus the best team in South America. And João Havelange, who was FIFA president at the time, was pushing for the creation of this competition that would pit the best European team against the best South American team. And there wasn't really an official way to decide the best South American team. So the Copa Libertadores and the Intercontinental Cup, were created at the same time in conjunction with each other. They both ran from 1960, and that was the first season. There were seven teams from seven different countries in the first season of the Copa Libertadores, and it's been running ever since then.
How much do we want to get into the format and structure of qualification, Graham? Because as you said, you've got the minimum of four per nation, but they're coming in at different points in qualifying. Yeah. There's different phases, and then there's other ways teams can qualify as well.
So I'll do a quick TLDR of qualification and the format. So anyone who has a vague idea of how qualifying for the Champions League, the European Champions League, works will have a grasp of how it works for the Copa Libertadores too. Same sort of concept. So a lot of the CONMEBOL countries have Apertura and Clausura half-year tournaments. Bolivia, Colombia, Ecuador, Paraguay, Peru, Uruguay and Venezuela all have this. And so if you win either of these titles, you get a spot for the Libertadores. Argentina, Brazil and Chile have European style league seasons. So there's one champion per season. They qualify for the Libertadores. And then similar to the Champions League, the other teams that finish near the top of the table also qualify. And there's also some spots attached to the domestic cups as well in some of these countries. And similar to the Champions League as well, some teams go automatically into the group stage and others enter the qualifying stage. There's three qualification phases. So some teams will play six matches before they even get to the group stage. The format is even more straightforward than that. It's eight groups of four. The top two in each group enter the knockout phase, which is a round of 16, then a quarterfinal, then a semi-final, and then a final. Pretty standard stuff. Until 2019, what wasn't standard was that the final was two-legged, which was somewhat unusual. And honestly, just for the weirdness of it and the variety of it, I kind of liked it. It was one of the things that made the Copa Lib unique. The last ever two-legged Libertadores final was the infamous Super Classical final between Boca and River, which we might talk more about a little bit later on, which was abandoned and then was played at the Bernabeu, of course. What a wild ride that final was. But it's been a one-off final at a neutral venue in the last few years, and that seems to be the plan going forward as well.
And historically, we've had non-South American teams participate, specifically Mexico. I don't believe they've ever won. They've made a couple different finals. But historically, we've got a lot of Argentine dominance, right? Mm. And then maybe more recently, a lot of Brazilian dominance.
So going right back to the first season, Peñarol from Uruguay were the first winners, and they were pretty dominant force in the Libertadores over the first few years. Santos were the first Brazilian winners in 1962, and then you had the first Argentinian winners in 1964 when Independiente won it. That Santos team, by the way, that I mentioned, was the Pelé Santos team that attracted global recognition as one of the best teams in the world, possibly the best team in the world at that time. So they were maybe the first iconic team to win the Copa Lib. Through the late 60s and certainly into the 70s, though, Argentinian teams dominated the Libertadores. Olimpia from Paraguay were the first club from outside that trio of Argentina, Brazil and Uruguay to win it in 1979. And then in 1989, Atlético Nacional became the first Pacific team there from Colombia to win it. It had been Atlantic Coast teams all the way up until then. So there are some there are some big historic moments in this competition's history. Pele provided some of the earliest iconic moments, and particularly the 1963 final against Boca. So this was a meeting between the two superpowers of Argentinian and Brazilian soccer, Boca versus Santos, of course. Pele was the best player in the world. He scored 5 goals in the tournament that year, including one in the final. And that was the first time a Brazilian club had lifted the Libertadores on Argentinian soil. So that's certainly memorable. Interestingly, Maradona never won the Libertadores during his career, either at, he was at Argentina Juniors, wasn't he? And then Boca Juniors as well. Never won the Copa Lib. Talking of Boca Juniors, the 2000 final between Boca and Palmeiras, I think, was an iconic final. Match went to a penalty shootout, which was won by Boca. Oscar Cordoba, who was the goalkeeper, was the hero for Boca, and that one's still talked about to this day. In 2008, so these are obviously becoming a little bit more modern, Liga de Quito became the first Ecuadorian team to ever win the Libertadores, beating Fluminense in the final. That was another shootout. By the way, these two games, I couldn't find many highlights of these two games on YouTube, but the scoreline suggests this was an absolute barn burner of a match. So the two legs finished 5-5. Liga won the first leg 4-2 and then Flu staged a comeback in the second leg but lost in the shootout. Nothing though, and I realise this is recency bias, but in terms of like iconic historic moments, nothing in my mind compares to the 2018 final between Boca and River Plate. I take it you remember that game, Taylor? I wasn't part of the TSS. Yeah, I was going to say I wasn't part of the TSS team back then, but
we watched it while like having our flight canceled at the Atlanta airport. We watched it like in a bar on our phones. But yes, it was a very important game that we definitely wanted to watch. And yes, I think stands out for the rivalry as well as the semi-quality of that game. I remember it not being the best quality, but also not being the worst.
Yeah, so I'm sure plenty of listeners remember this game vividly, but if you didn't catch it, this was the first time ever there'd been a Superclásico final. That's the rivalry between Boca and River Plate, the two biggest clubs in Argentina. The first leg was postponed because of biblical rain in Buenos Aires, so that was the first thing. They then came back the next day, and it was a 2-2 draw, so pretty exciting game. Then there was the infamous second leg, which was abandoned due to fan violence around the Monumental. The Boca bus was attacked on its way to the game. A few days passed, and then CONMEBOL decided that the second leg would be played in Madrid at the Bernabeu, which I don't know if you've looked recently, Taylor, at a map, but that's not in South America.
No?
Madrid or the Bernabeu, yeah. So that was weird.
Big if true. Yeah.
When the second leg was finally played, it went to extra time and River won it 3-1 in the end. So, again, I appreciate recency bias, but I think that will take some beating as the most iconic Copa Lib final of all time.
I think, iconic, dramatic, and then engaging at the same time, even if not for like the best possible reasons. The only other one I had on my list, because you covered a lot of ground there, thank you for that. Did you mention the 2011 final?
No, I didn't.
I think that one is somewhat significant for a specific winner of that one. It's Santos drawing Peñarol, who obviously have plenty of historic pedigree in this competition. They draw the first leg at home, or away. They win at home 2-1 with Neymar scoring a goal. And that is Neymar as he's breaking through. I think he is like just loses out on the golden boot in that one. But it's him winning the competition with Santos and I believe making the move to Barcelona the year after that. So it felt like that was a good sort of end point for his domestic Brazil career before he then makes the jump to Barcelona. So that one somewhat significant because of that Neymar connection.
Yeah, the other one that I remember very vaguely, so this is about the time I'm starting to watch a lot of football, was 2007 Copa Lib final. Boca versus Gremio. I remember those two games particularly. I'm trying to remember. I don't know if I watched both of these. It might have been the second one. The second game, I think I remember in particular being the Riquelme final. So it's 2-0 in the second leg. He scores both goals. I'm sure one of those goals is just an incredible goal. Riquelme was one of my favourite players around that time. Like when you were playing in the playground or wherever in the local park, Riquelme was one of the players that kids would pretend to be. And I remember that final as being the one that he, over the two legs, he scored 3 goals over the two legs. So he kind of took over that final and Boca won that one pretty convincingly, 5-0 in aggregate.
And so over the course of the competition's history, it has been, I would say somewhat balanced. Early on, it's what? Peñarol twice in a row, Santos twice in a row, as you said, and then it's Independiente, Peñarol. Then you get like a bunch of Estudiantes, a bunch of Independiente, and then it's varied up until recently, where it has been Brazil. The last five, right, have all been won by Brazilian clubs, six of the last seven, and then since 2011, I think you could make that nine of the last winners have all been from Brazil, two from Argentina, one from Colombia, three from Argentina, excuse me, and then one from Colombia in there. Graham, how do we account for the relative dominance of these Brazilian clubs? Because it's not all the same ones. You've got Flamengo winning twice, you've got Palmeiras winning twice, Fluminense last season. So it's not even as though one has been fully dominant, but Brazil on the whole have been pretty dominant.
Yeah, the reason is money. In world football, in pretty much every competition, a little bit depressing, because I think up until recently, the Copa Libertadores was, I'm not saying there weren't dominant clubs and there weren't richer clubs, but it did feel like it was ripe for an outsider to make a run, and maybe we saw that a couple times in the kind of 2000s happen. And now that dynamic has changed, and that's not a particularly welcome change in my mind. But yeah, I wrote about this for the newsletter before last year's final between Fluminense and Boca Juniors. Even a club like Boca Juniors, with their size and stature, they are traditionally or historically one of the most successful teams in the Copa Libertadores. They've played in the most finals. They've won it six times. Even they are getting sort of cut adrift by the Brazilian teams, and I wrote about it for the newsletter, and the financial gulf is opening up between the Brazilian clubs and the rest in South American soccer. They are cherry-picking the best players from the other leagues, and they're also spending big to bring back established Brazilian stars like Marcelo or Felipe Melo, who was in both in the Fluminense team last season, or Gabigol, who was at Inter and then came back to Brazil to go to Flamengo. So that's the main reason. This year the final will be in Buenos Aires, so there is a real incentive for the Argentinian clubs to be in that game. The chances are, though, that it might be an all-Brazilian final, which the symbolism of that would be quite profound, to have an all-Brazilian final at in the spiritual home of Argentinian football at the Monumental. But that's the reality of the Copa Libertadores. And there was a good article by Tim Vickery. He had a couple of articles on this actually for ESPN and for the BBC this week, because this is the start of the Copa Libertadores group stages for this season. And the outlook that he gives, the impression he gives, that this isn't going to change anytime soon. The TV revenue, the TV broadcast deals that are in place for the next few years are only going to consolidate the Brazilian club's position of strength. It feels like more effort has been put into the commercial side of things in Brazil that just isn't replicated in some of the other countries, even Argentina. Post-World Cup winners, maybe a little bit surprising, but that's the reality of it. So yeah, I think this is the new normal for the Copa Lib, is that it's going to be dominance from the Brazilian teams from here on out, at least for a good period.
In your opinion, as a neutral to this, is that better or worse? Because I think the pro argument would be that if you have no real vested interest in Argentina or Colombia or whomever winning silverware, then you just want the best quality. And if you have Brazilian clubs being able to spend money and bring back big name players, but then also bring in some of the best players from the continent, like there's an argument that then you get more quality in a smaller pool, but that means you get better games in the knockout rounds. Conversely, it is always fun to have the randomness of some of these teams making runs and learning more about these clubs that you don't know much about, because they've suddenly put together a team, a golden generation or whatever it may be, that can have those runs that less likely to happen. So I think there are pros and cons. I wonder where you fall on this one, Graham.
I think this depends on what your viewpoint is as a fan, and maybe where you're located in the world as a fan. So I'd imagine the South American perspective is that there's a rather large pro to this changing dynamic, and that the teams are getting better, right? The quality of the soccer is generally better. The players that are coming back to Brazil are established stars. As you say, Taylor, they're managing to pool a lot of the talent from South America before they head to Europe, maybe earlier in their career. So you're going to get better teams and better games from that. For me, as a non-South American, I kind of already have the European Champions League for like the highest level of soccer. And I look to the Copa Libertadores, and I have watched more of the Copa Lib in recent years, really since the Super Clásico final in 2018. I was going to maybe talk about this a little bit later on, but I think that's had a huge knock-on effect in raising interest in the Copa Libertadores is that final, which was such a huge event. It was on the BBC, on mainstream TV in the UK. I don't know whether that effect has been replicated in the US, but speaking for myself, I think there's been a knock-on effect. So I'm watching more of this competition, but I don't watch it primarily for the quality of soccer. I watch it for the other things that the Copa Libertadores brings. You know, it's maybe a bit of a cliche, but the, you know, the passion of the crowds, I think that is a real factor. The atmospheres that are produced at these games, it's a different culture. So I think it depends on your viewpoint. But I do find it a little bit sad that the scope for an outsider to make a run in this competition is closing, because we've already seen that in the European Champions League. And I think the European Champions League is worse off for not having that possibility, for that ray of hope. So that's my opinion.
How do you feel the atmosphere compares to the atmosphere for Champions League games or Champions League knockout games? Because I am similarly inclined to think that part the atmosphere, the just the rowdiness of the supporters, the volume of the supporters, that is part of the selling point for Copa Lib.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in terms of the general vibe of the Libertadores, it feels authentic in a way that the Champions League doesn't always. Now, of course, I'm making a sweeping generalization about the Champions League there. The atmosphere at the Etihad for a group stage game against, you know, whoever, FC Copenhagen, is not going to be as good as if Celtic, for example, were ever to make it to a round of 16 game again at Celtic Park. That atmosphere is clearly going to be electric. So I'm making generalizations here. But yeah, the atmosphere at Libertadores matches is, I've never been to one in person, so I'm giving my impression watching on TV primarily, but it seems to be something special. I think the matches can be a little bit scrappy, but once you get to the high stakes matches and in the knockout rounds, the intensity is always there. And yeah, I just feel like it's a window into the culture of these clubs in a way that the Champions League isn't. I don't know whether that's down to cheaper ticket prices that allow the hardcore supporters to make it to these matches. I know there's an issue with away fans travelling to Copa Libertadores games a lot of the times because of the economic landscape is just different in South America to how it is in European soccer. I accept that. But nonetheless, it's a huge selling point for me as the atmosphere and just the general vibe around the competition.
We have been very positive about the tournament. If we're being balanced, what would you say are the negatives or the drawbacks to Copa Lib?
Well, as I say, I think a lot of the matches can be a little bit scrappy. I've also watched a lot of games on, how would I put it, tatty fields?
Yeah.
Like, yeah, poor quality pitches, like a lot of CONCACAF. I know it's not CONCACAF, but in terms of how they feel.
Same vibe.
Yeah. same vibe about the playing surface and a lot of, but at the same time, like, that's part of its charm. Like, I don't need the Copa Libertadores, and this is what I'm talking about with, it depends on your viewpoint. If you're South American, I can imagine you want your continental competition to be the highest quality possible. You probably want pristine pitches. But for me, I'm not looking to the Copa Libertadores for that. I kind of look to the Champions League for that. This offers something a little bit different. But I think that, yeah, the conditions, the treatment of players, like, you read a lot of kind of the lesser funded clubs from some of the smaller countries having to drive like hours through the night to get to games rather than flying or flying at all, or, you know, flying in you know, first class or whatever, like some of the bigger clubs would. So there's a divide between the resources of the biggest clubs in the region and some of the smaller clubs, and that can affect the product.
I think you've already answered this, but just to have it clear, we do then get the Club World Cup after this one, and it, like, very often it ends up being the winners of the Copa Lib playing the winners of the European Champions League. And I think oftentimes that can be looked upon as like, yeah, see the difference? The European side almost always wins that one. I'm assuming that you would say that that is probably not the way to gauge the successfulness of Copa Libertadores if their team then ends up winning the Club World Cup.
Oh yeah, I don't think that indicates anything at all. I mean, we already know that the European Champions League teams are of a higher quality than the Copa Libertadores teams, just through the fact that the best players from South America go to Europe, because that's where the richest clubs are. That's where they make the most money. I just don't know what we learn from a one-off match. And I guess this is maybe me talking as a Scottish football fan. Just because something is lower quality doesn't diminish its worth. Like, that's not the only gauge. That's not the only way that we measure soccer. So Copa Libertadores has lots to offer, and their teams have lots to offer. Fernando Diniz, the Fluminense manager, I enjoyed reading about him, and I listened to a couple of podcasts about him last season, and his reputation in Brazilian soccer, like seen as the Pep Guardiola of Brazilian soccer. And so there are these icons that we don't get the exposure to in the Western world. Certainly speaking for myself here in the UK, didn't have much exposure to Fernando Diniz, who of course was the interim Brazilian manager for a period as well. And so the Copa Libertadores is a window into these leagues, into these cultures, and I enjoy that exposure. I feel like I learn something every time I watch a match in this competition.
So how would you say we should cover it then on TSS? If we're talking about it, I'm assuming you would agree we should talk about it more often. I feel like we end up only talking about the final. Yeah. Is it worth talking about like the warts and all oddities of the tournament? Is it worth just focusing on the bigger games, the bigger players? That's where I think I struggle with how to sort of include it in our coverage, is if you're coming at it from a less informed perspective, if you don't have a history with certain clubs, certain players, whatever it may be, I think it's harder to kind of know what the interesting wrinkles are, the interesting stories might be.
Yeah, and this is the weekly balance that we have to strike on the show, is there's just too much soccer, right? So I am resistant to adding more to our plate. But I think the right balance to strike at this point anyway would be, yeah, to cover the more important games or the more notable games. You know, if there was a match that really caught the eye in the group stage or in the early knockout rounds, then we would mention that. I can only speak to my own experience over here in Old Blighty. Old Blighty, wow, I hated that for me. Old Blighty, that's a Ryan Bailey term in Britain. But anyway, the Copa Libertadores
is shaking my head.
That was coming through the mic, you shaking your head, the energy of that. The Copa Libertadores, as I mentioned earlier, is definitely getting more attention recently. And I think that has come from the 2018 final. The final now is on the BBC every year, and I bet it gets big audiences. I wonder if more people watch the Copa Libertadores final in the UK than the Champions League final, because it's on free-to-air linear TV. Don't underestimate how much of a difference that makes in the UK, by the way. TNT Sports don't have a huge number of subscribers. That's who broadcast the Champions League. You put something on BBC One on a Sunday, millions will watch it. And that's where the Copa Libertadores has been the last few years. But yes, generally speaking, the Copa Lib could use better media coverage in the Western world, because it has got so much to offer. And if matches were more readily available, that's the key thing for me, is the big matches are on the BBC. I don't think anyone's shown the group stage matches or even the early knockout round games. I don't know. I think that is different in the US. Maybe CBS have those rights, I think, in the US. Maybe they're on Paramount Plus. I would watch those games more often, but it is a difficult balance to strike because there's just so much damn soccer that we have to watch.
Indeed, dude. Indeed. Well, MLS supporters, obviously, their clubs will not be playing in this competition, but River this season have Leandro Gonzalez Pires, they've got PT Martinez, and they've got Ezequiel Barco. So maybe Atlanta fans who want to know how things are working out for them can go check them out. They've also got Claudio Echeverri, a player I know nothing about other than that he is 18 years old, was sold to Manchester City and then loaned back. So maybe he is one for the future. So I'm going to say check out River and maybe watch Fluminense, because Felipe Melo could do incredible things or could get a red card for assault at any given moment.
Yeah, that is the line that he walks a lot of the time. That River team is like a listener question that we would get. Like, how would the 2021/22 Atlanta United team get on in Argentinian football in the Copa Lib? Well, I guess we'll have an answer to that.
Don't encourage people, Graham. Don't encourage people. Instead, I'll just say thank you all so much for listening to this episode of 101. Watch some Copa Lib and then tell myself and Graham Ruffin about it. Graham, thank you for bringing all the knowledge to this episode, as always.
Thank you, Taylor Rockwell.
Listeners, thank you all so much. We'll talk to you again next week.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.